Welcome to the Blockchain DNA Podcast. This show brings you the latest in blockchain technology and global developments in business and fintech. Presented by Metaverse DNA.
Hi, I'm Alex Lightman, and I'm the CEO of Keymoji. This is the Lightman Report, and this will be our second episode that's on DeFi, decentralized finance. And this is New Perspectives of DeFi, part two. So when Satoshi Nakamoto, on Halloween, published the 2008, published a white paper, he wanted to let people know that there was a new solution to banking and allowing people to send money directly to each other and without any intermediaries. DeFi Binance banking is one of the most important things we can do because the core of any capitalist society is borrowing and lending money for things and doing it preferably as widely as possible and with to as many people as possible with as low interest rate as possible. Basically, having efficient banking is critical, and we have about 2 billion people who still don't have bank accounts. And so what are they gonna do? Put the money in their pockets, their mattress. If they're in Kenya, they can use M-Pesa, but not everybody has a system like M-Pesa. You have to have a whole lot of other people using it as well. So DeFi banking is banking done via the blockchain. It can resolve some of the issues that I just brought up. And privacy comes from the security of the blockchain's distributed ledger, which includes something that's out of the control of people who want to just change the records and cover up their crimes. Since the blockchain can handle everything, including peer-to-peer transactions, there isn't a need for intermediaries, with the exception of needing to do compliance. Compliance is a big part of banking, and part of the reason that banks don't really want to bank the poor is that on average, at least in the United States, it costs about $200 per customer per year just to handle the paperwork and the compliance. So if you add up all the costs of the lawyers, lawsuits, dealing with government regulations, that comes to about $200 per customer. So the banks have to earn more than that on each customer that they have just to start making a profit. If they don't make $200, they don't even begin to break even. So KYC and AML are two things that are required by government to keep banking officials, banking executives out of jail. KYC is know your customer. And DeFi and blockchain are helping there too. A consortium of 6 banks and licensing authorities in the United Arab Emirates, which has about 10% of the world's oil, formed in February to share verified data about customers using blockchain. The 6 banks in the consortium include Emirates, NBD, Emirates Islamic Bank, the Sharia compliant subsidiaries of Emirates NBD, HSBC, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, National Bank of Ras Al Khaimah, Abu Dhabi Commercial Bank, and the Commercial Bank of Dubai. And they held about 44% of all the banking assets in UAE, according to Moody's last year. We have the category of DeFi derivatives. A derivative is a financial contract between 2 or more parties that derives its value from the performance of an underlying entity. This entity can be an asset, it can be an interest rate, an index, bonds, commodities, and it's often just called underlying. Derivatives in decentralized finance offer a lot of flexibility across multiple assets and platforms. Smart contracts can issue tokenized derivative contracts, which are executed permissionless and automatically if you have those smart contracts set up. And that's one of the reasons for setting up Ethereum in the first place. If you saw the previous episode, I was talking about all the different contracts, over $1 billion is now locked up in Ethereum for these kind of contracts for DeFi. Pseudonymity. Decentralized financial applications should be able to leverage Web 3.0 standards for signing of transactions and authentication. And they can drastically reduce the need for anti-money laundering and KYC and making financial tools inclusive to a broader audience. So the idea is you give more tools to more people so that in an ideal situation, you've got about 6 billion smartphones. So what you want is anyone with a smartphone able to buy, sell, borrow, loan, swap, do derivatives with anybody else. Crypto and real-world assets. So Tim Draper is investing in DeFi money markets, DAO, digital autonomous organization, according to DMM Foundation's official announcements. The DMM protocol is a bridge between Ethereum digital assets on the one side and real-world assets. The DMM protocol is an interface that lets anyone earn 6.25% backed by real-world assets by visiting the blockchain-backed DeFi money market app. Now, considering that regular bank deposits in many countries are paying negative interest rates, and as we discussed, we recently had the historical first of a negative cost of a barrel of oil, according to a future contract. So 6.25 is a lot of money by current standards of fiat. So we also have DeFi prediction markets. We mentioned them in our last episode. Prediction markets are created for the benefit of researchers, speculators, and traders looking to bet on future events. Generally, their main purpose is for market participants to take advantage of the outcome of events. The predictions can range from exchange averages to quarterly sales reports for a specific company to elections or even commodity prices. And we can have, for instance, four future scenarios. Scenario A, more efficient and interoperable network. Scenario B, geopolitical wars of unicorn coins. Scenario C, emergence of financial autonomous agents. Scenario D, market of DeFi robo-advisors. And within this more efficient interoperable networks, you can have the ideology of crypto anarchism. Blockchain should replace institutions. Hot technologies include decentralized oracles, lightning, interoperable ledgers, etc. The winners and the losers are public protocols are the winners and banks and fintech are the losers. The growth mode is efficiency and interoperability. And the use cases are alternative trust system, bypass local bans, empower oppressed creativity. Scenario B, geopolitical wars of unicorn coins. Ideology is pure capitalism, the privatization of monetary system. The hot technologies are stable coins and federated networks. The winners are unicorns, things that have a valuation over a billion US dollars. Fiat currencies, growth mode. Fiat currencies, of course, are the losers in this scenario. And there is a whole long list of dead fiat currencies. So fiat currencies always go to zero at some point. Growth mode, legal compliance, use cases, global inefficiencies. And this, of course, includes Libra. And then emergence, scenario C is emergence of financial autonomous agents. The ideology is techno-futurisms. The idea, this is Google's idea of AI and technology can do better than humans, and anything a technology or an AI can do better than a human, it should. The hot technologies are federative learning and ensemble learning, machine learning, and all of its flavors. And the winners include decentralized AI apps, and the losers are existing institutions with a lot of employees, a lot of bricks and mortar at a time when things can go on networks. The growth mode is creative convergence. The use cases are alternative trust system and basically TBC. We're gonna see how that turns out. Scenario D is market for DeFi robo-advisors. The ideology is humanism. Technology should empower humans. This is more the Elon Musk version of things with Neuralace. Hot technologies include also federative learning and ensemble learning. The winners are supportive AI apps that help people, and the losers are institutions. The growth mode is AI and machine learning adoption, and the use cases are supporting people creatively. Singularity.net and Numerai are two of the exemplars of this. So what we want to make this whole thing work is transparent, to have everything be transparent and trustless. And you have these different layers. The layer zero, as based on Ethereum, layer one is the DAI savings rate stability fee, layer two, the borrow lend rates, layer three is the Ethereum locked in DeFi, layer four is the liquidity. So you have these different layers as you see here, including the application layer and the user aggregation layer. The current custodian of an asset in a DeFi project should always be verifiable on the blockchain, and its custody should only involve smart contracts and wallets. There should not be large, centralized, exchange-owned wallets in a DeFi product. In the presence of a smart contract, the code for the same should be open-sourced. Everything should be permissionless, unlike open finance. Decentralized finance should allow anyone to create applications without the need for applications being approved by large central banking authorities. There shouldn't be censorship. There shouldn't be the censorship and gamesmanship of the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store. Keeping in mind, you could define a decentralized financial application as a censorship-resistant, transparent tool that enables the transfer, custody, and exchange of tokenized assets that may be fungible or non-fungible in a permissionless environment with almost no requirements for identity verification. Decentralized finance varies from open finance in the conventional sense because much of the stack in open finance relies heavily on traditional banking entities that require strong AML, anti-money laundering, and KYC, know your customer requirements, and fall largely under the regulatory purview of government bodies. So here are some of the trends in DeFi as of the time that this was made in April 20th, 2020. Eric Voorhees bought Portis, a two-year-old cryptocurrency wallet that's integrated into more than 70 DeFi applications. Bitcoin-backed loans became popular. Atomic Loans, a startup focused on developing peer-to-peer Bitcoin-backed loans, announced it's raised $2.45 million in seed funding, led by Initialized Capital. And 40,000 people use DeFi applications monthly as of January 2020, according to Binance Research. Eric Voorhees has said, the DeFi stuff, I think, is the most interesting because of how quickly it's moving, of how many tiny startups are emerging every day, and how each of them work together. Now, part of the reason they work together is because of this extraordinary characteristic of DeFi in that it's built on a mountain of open source software. So if you add up all of the cost that's been paid to all of the developers or all the volunteered hours, it comes to tens of billions of dollars. And think about all the companies that have had to pay for all of their apps that are out of date. Imagine being able to just get the latest and greatest software that a lot of other people are doing. So there's a level of interoperability and having it already done. And finally, we have the latest news and trends too. Justin Sun announced the launch of Jed, now Just. The project is the MakerDAO DeFi version of Tron. Sun noted that the Tron stablecoin will be backed by the United States dollar. And the development of Just is a milestone supporting Tron's DeFi ecosystem. Coinbase wallet users can now lend out their crypto and earn interest on decentralized finance through Coinbase wallet. So if you have stuff on Coinbase, start earning money on it. Hopefully, if you got one thing out of this and you can earn a little bit of money, that this could be useful to you. And thousands of Coinbase wallet users have already deposited millions of dollars into DeFi apps like Compound and DYDX, earning interest rates up to 6% APR. And the makers of Keep Protocol raised $7.7 million to bring trustless Bitcoin to DeFi. So here's our last slide for this one, just to give you a feel of all the companies in the field. With decentralized finance, we have our shot of making basically a whole new world of financial applications that can fulfill the big vision that Satoshi Nakamoto spelled out in the first Bitcoin white paper, Halloween 2008. And it came at a time when banks were on the brink of yet another bailout. Decentralized finance builds upon this vision of giving individuals dignity, sovereignty, and transparency about how their hard-earned assets are stored and invested. This isn't the anti-banking establishment. It's the pro-consumer choice. And in building it, you're not derailing the power of government or banks, but empowering the common man, common person, to have an alternative in an ecosystem where there hasn't been that kind of option for centuries. So this is Alex Lightman for the Lightman Report, and I'll see you soon.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now, back to the show.
I would like to welcome everybody to the follow-up interview to the Alex Lightman Report number 4 and talk a little bit about what he discussed in that report. Alex, I thought it was very interesting because you mentioned a lot of the influences of the newest blockchain technologies in the existing economic reality. And the speeding up of developments due to COVID-19 and everything that we talked about over the last weeks. When you spoke about breaking up the existing asset classes, I mean, that is quite, I would say, something we haven't seen, new asset classes in many, many years in the existing economy. What do you think, what will happen first in this area, do you think?
Well, I think that there's going to be quite a lot of shift in derivatives. So derivatives, we look at the big numbers. There's a joke going around now. I made it myself, but of course other people have done it. Everett Dirksen said, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. And now people are casually, housewives, taxi drivers, coal miners are talking about trillion here, trillion there. First thing, you know, then you're talking about real money. The global GDP last year was something around $80 trillion. It could be 10 to 20% lower this year, but let's say it's around 80 trillion. And the total value of all the assets before COVID-19 was about 380 trillion. Now, there in the derivatives market, that's in the quadrillions. So you have, you know, millions times a million times a thousand is a billion times a thousand is a trillion times a thousand is a quadrillion. So you're talking about a market that's, yeah, it's just blips in computers, but it's pretty huge. And I can't imagine that this market won't experience massive shifts. And I think that some of these shifts are going to happen when the public is able to transact with tokenized, permissionless blockchain solutions. I also think we're going to see a lot of different new asset classes as you can make new things with the blockchain, because the software is mostly open source. There's a community of people. And I have seen a number of people who were from traditional banking. So I know a person who's worked for the largest commercial bank in the United States, and which grew, which is now more than all the European banks put together. And he left traditional banking after decades of being the leading person in the world in one sector. And he's now focused on blockchain and crypto. So as these people come into crypto, I think they're going to bring some ideas, but they're going to go, oh, wait, I'm like a painter who, instead of using water, using oils that are very expensive to try everything, using watercolors. And if you have been painting in, you know, one tiny tube and painting in oils, this can be $100. But if you're using watercolors, they're practically free. And in fact, you can even use house paints. So my girlfriend, when she's painting, just goes to Lowe's and buys house paints. All of a sudden, you have this new palette to create new kinds of products. And we'll talk about other kinds of specifics, but I think that that's the general picture, is that this is the year when people have to invent something new. There's just no way to keep the existing infrastructure of all these banks and brokerages and there with their big fat fees, especially when there's a saying in America, how are you going to keep them down on the farm when they've seen Gay Perry? You know, meaning if they see something amazing. And the thing that's got to hit everybody in traditional finance is somebody wiring $1.2 billion and paying a $70 fee. I mean, we have the ability in crypto to do instant transactions that are virtually free. And what's the financial industry doing if they're just serving as intermediaries between people buying, selling, borrowing, loaning, and swapping, and our fees are one, two, or three orders of magnitude lower than theirs?
If you go there, Eric, and you look at, you know, platform ideas of Metaverse DNA, are you looking at creating any new asset classes that we haven't seen before? Maybe even this year, if you care to elaborate on that?
Well, it's not up to me to create new asset class. I think the people out there will be creating new asset class. I actually echo what Alex just said. There will be a lot of new asset class to be created in a very short time after the COVID-19. There are a lot of things, a lot of fundamental things has changed. I actually see a lot of things going on, and these things can be put on a permissionless chain like DNA later on. Just give you an example. A group of friends in Toronto, they are doing something called a GIF, GIF, which is animation. Animation. It's an artistry work. They're artists, right? So they've been given a new tool, which is internet or say a computer. So you can have a new art, and this art are online, but you know that the problem with things online that you can copy paste, but with blockchain, the GIF they just created has a unique blockchain ID, which is an asset class, a new asset class. Interestingly, there are some auction sites for this GIF art. And one of my friends just recently sold his piece for $600.
Wow.
Yes. Three ethers. And she's kind, he's kind enough to teach my daughter how to do this. I said, okay, now she has another career choice on the blockchain. So a lot of new things happening.
What you're actually saying is that we're opening up asset classes like previously maybe we opened Facebook or YouTube to anybody post anything that they would like, but just in a completely different realm, which is basically asset classes, which, you know, we've seen some attempts to do that with content, but to do it specifically with art. I think one of the future reports, Alex, should be about a tremendously interesting asset class that is called tokenizing existing assets, you know, like art, like real estate, like all these things, because previously in blockchain, we saw a lot of developments into, I would say, new type of things, you know, financing projects, creating new things. But there's an enormous capacity in the market to tokenize existing assets and create asset classes. And that's really a remarkable thing. We see some very tiny developments like STOs and other things. We're finding our way. But it's not just the traditional STO replacing the IPO. I think it's all types of asset classes. Like it's art. It's whatever you can think of that can be a new asset class. And anybody can create them on a permissionless blockchain. That's the beauty of it, I think.
Just add on to it. So I heard people saying that a blockchain is a tool for people to digitize their assets. So a lot of time I try to correct them. I say blockchain not only are capable of digitized assets. There's just another class we call digital asset. Asset digitization and digital asset are actually two things. So when you digitize assets, you're actually digitized current existing physical assets.
Yes.
But there are assets native to internet or native to blockchain that has actually created on-chain or say on the internet. Like the digital art we just mentioned, right? And when we have an avatar, we have a digital identity, that actually proves that we are the rightful owner of that piece of art. Then you can start to auction. Then you have value. Same thing as, the property rights. Like so digital property rights, right? Things like that.
I think you had the perfect subject for one of the future Lightman reports. What's actually the difference between creating digital assets or digitized existing assets, which is an extremely interesting subject, because I think digitizing existing assets, because of the way we're transforming our banking, financial institutions, the way that we transact with each other, is going to have a massive influence on everything that's towards the future is changing, and it's doing it at a rapid pace at the moment. If we, you know, Alex, if one of the topics that you raised in your report is pseudonymity, you know, already Eric sort of referred to digital identity, that whole area of pseudonymity, digital identity. You said, you know, the more tools, the cheaper, and the more people will use them. But of course, that area of pseudonymity is extremely important to have a permissionless, trustless blockchain. So how do you see that whole area of function?
Well, we can divide that into two classes. One is the things that are illegal, so people wanting to evade taxes. And then there's the whole nature of corporate identity and institutional identity. There's personal identity. So Ingo Walters wrote a book called The Secret Money Market. And an older edition said that the market for pseudonymity or anonymity was over $150 billion a year. People are willing to give up that much money to have it. And it's not all illegal. I mean, obviously, you have the people who want to evade things, but you also have husbands and wives who don't want to tell each other their assets in case they're going to get divorced. you have people who want to engage in gambling, or they want to have a steak dinner when they're not supposed to have that, you know, and they're, somebody's going to nag at them. Or you have people who want to procure sex or porn. You have people who want to gamble, etc. And you also have, let's say, the cruise lines. The cruise lines, you have these, this cruise line based out of that's based out of Florida, but the ships are registered in the Bahamas and in Liberia and in Panama and so on. And you may not want the, all the passengers to know that they're on a Liberian or a Panamanian ship. So you use this pseudonymity for corporations. In fact, basically, corporations are living people who have lots and lots of pseudonyms. We're just so used to corporations having pseudonyms that we don't even think about it. But in fact, that's what brand names and corporate names are, is they're pseudonyms. So I think that within this whole world, we have to strike a balance. And what's going to be very interesting is when you can do KYC, Know Your Customer, and AML on the pseudonyms. And then, you know, so you can have your pseudonym as a trusted entity, even if it's not in your own name. And I think that this is a world that crypto is going to own. I just don't see traditional banking being there. And it's just a matter of going of crypto people doing what they were doing with, let's say, the leader of Malta, and just saying, hey, look, you know, do you want to be the leader in crypto? Crypto's rising faster. You want to create jobs. You want to create, you know, new capital inflows in a world that's starved for dollars and starved for jobs and starved for positive news. Because unless you're, you know, a government that can say we beat COVID, you're looking pretty bad in the press these days. So everybody's looking for a positive story of what they're doing. And in general, as Thomas Friedman has pointed out, there's a $75 trillion thundering herd, he called it, of money. And there's a saying that capital goes where it's invited and stays where it's treated well. Well, that's true of crypto assets as well, which are now back to being worth hundreds of billions of dollars. They'll go where they're invited, and crypto assets will go where crypto people are invited, and they'll stay where crypto people are treated well. And that one includes legal basis for pseudonymity.
If you hear what Alex just referred to, Eric, on the ETP mainnet of Metaverse, there is already an avatar, there is already a large direction into digital identity. How do you see the next steps in that?
Well, we have digital identity on the ETP chain right now, and we are going to release our DNA chain very soon, hopefully next month, and we hopefully we'll have much secure, put a lot of security on the current digital identity on it. And the DNA chain will have a lot of speed. So faster transaction, just enable what we already have. So what we already have is security and tokenization and the digital identity. When we have faster transaction speed, and hopefully we will have a decentralized exchange very soon as on DNA chain. So these things combined together, I think will trigger a lot of new DeFi application. This is what we are actually hoping for.
Yeah, Alex, you also spoke in your reports about, you know, it not being the anti-banking movement, but more of a customer's choice. Like, you know, customers will go where they're treated well. I mean, you see that, for instance, only last month in Portugal, who is fighting, you know, their economic situation by saying, you know, they're going to be very crypto friendly. I think it's a major step in the right direction to enable people to just be there and not having to have all sorts of constructions worldwide, but just, you know, be out in the open, being an exchange, being trading in crypto. I see, if we look at that and you see this whole development, and I refer back to your earlier reports about e-commerce, do you see that these two things, like having that pseudonymity or maybe an avatar or digital identity, which is basically a secure being on a blockchain, influence e-commerce in an even stronger way than it is now? Because if I buy something online now in e-commerce, if I do it, I would say in the regular economy, I still will have to identify myself in the traditional space. You know, do you see a development that this whole movement into trustless transactions will influence e-commerce in an even bigger way than it already has?
Sure. I think that we're going to see quite a lot of new business models emerge around immunity passports for COVID. So I could foresee, for instance, I don't know that I can name the country, but there's a country whose central banks recently collapsed, and it was underpinning their national airline. So their national airline has collapsed. And these people are in a place where they have to import a lot of their food. They're mainly based on tourism. And so I can see people who have the immunity passports getting together and making peer-to-peer airline charters, saying the only people who can fly on this are people who have had COVID and have the antibodies, or car rentals that have this. And a lot of people won't necessarily want to disclose their medical records, but they may want to have a pseudonym and say, this pseudonym has been KYC'd and AML'd and has an immunity passport. So it's the credentials that you want. So you have a container which has all of your attributes that can be checked, and then it gives selective permission to reveal certain aspects for certain kinds of vendors which have the access to that field or that record. And I can see that making a whole lot of products, because in general, people who don't feel they can get the virus or aren't contagious are going to want to separate themselves commercially from the people who could get it. Like, for instance, I can see people rearranging around nursing homes and hospitals. And some urgent care facilities will say, we only take people who have the immunity passports, and, you know, et cetera.
If we take that a little step further and look at what I would say a pseudonymity could mean on the internet, we now relate it to COVID because, you know, it's all very active in our minds every single day of our lives right now. But take that a little step further. We do have in some countries like credit registration based upon behavior. We do have all these, I would say, kind of phony reviews on the internet that are pushed by companies to make them look good. People are starting to doubt that more and more because it gets more out in the open.
I just read in the last 24 hours, 6 different people, someone was saying, oh, this got a 5-star review on Amazon. And then getting a bunch of people saying, oh, but those are all bought. I mean, it's right now, you've just put your finger on something that's, as we're buying so many things through one company, Amazon, that company is now coming under unprecedented scrutiny as we look at whether these things are true or not. We're looking and dissecting everything for truth.
If we now look at the developments that we just discussed, Eric, to close the subject off, if we look at that pseudonymity or an avatar or digital identity that basically verifies us as being genuine as to how we appear on the blockchain or the internet, do you see that extending way beyond just transaction? We just discussed immunity, but I could see validity in an opinion, validity in a lot of areas where you could have
peer-to-peer loans.
Yeah, well, Eric, I think it's one of your favorite subjects, peer-to-peer loans, because it's very much around the corner with the current situation. So how do you feel that this is going to develop?
Well, I think, all technology already there, just like Bitcoin. When Satoshi Nakamoto invented Bitcoin, he's actually not inventing anything. All the technology are there, like cryptography and everything. When we talk about digital identity, so the future development, we already have technical solution for that. We have zero knowledge proof, right? So we don't have to expose everything that's our true identity to the buyer or seller on Amazon, or say we can prove we are a credible seller without revealing who we did business before, like using a lot of technology. These technologies are already there. Just we need to make use of them. So we are at the beginning of digital identity, but later on, by putting these pieces of technology together, we will be able to solve a lot of the question we just mentioned. So yeah, we're going on the right direction. Let's go there.
Let's just go and see what happens in the next couple of weeks. It's exciting times. I want to thank you both for the review on the fourth Lightman report. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Eric. You, Alex Lightman, writer, futurist. I always like to call you futurist. Eric, you, visionary, I think, in the blockchain realm. Thank you both, and we'll see each other next week.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Blockchain DNA podcast. Make sure to visit our website and follow us on social media at DNA by Metaverse or at MVS DNA. Till next time.